I'm Linda from Tolbo for Business, and we're joined in the studio today by Sean Ashton from Omba Investments. He's a seasoned stock picker with a sharp eye for market trends. Well, Sean, welcome to BizNews.
Thanks, Linda.
Well, 2025 has been anything but predictable. I mean, we've got Trump's tariff and, you know, they've stirred global markets, creating volatility across sectors. And the AI revolution continues to reshape the investment landscape. So where does this leave us?
I think what's quite interesting, as we noted in the piece that we put out recently, is that if you are not invested in the Magnificent Seven grouping of stocks, yeah, so that's Alphabet, Nvidia, and Microsoft, a handful of large other ones, in 2024, you pretty much would have been left behind, and nothing much else that you did would have mattered much. But you've seen a very subtle, or not so subtle, shift in 2025, where markets have become more selective. And we think that's a natural evolution of this bull cycle that we're in at the moment, where you're moving from the initial phase, the infrastructure build-out phase of AI with investment in silicon, to the software beneficiaries of that investment phase. And so market leadership is just changing. It doesn't mean that the boom is over.
So what are the stocks to watch in this new landscape?
So I think what's quite interesting to note is that when you look at the Magnificent Seven grouping of stocks this year, and this is up until, call it the 9th of May when we penned the report, that grouping of stocks was down, call it 13%, in a market that was down 3%. Those were obviously the big winners from 2024. And so I think many market participants' conclusion might well be, well, the AI boom is over. But we've noted a handful of, let's call it, software leaders that have come through very strongly this year. Palantir is one to watch. It's up north of 50% this year. Duolingo, another in the cybersecurity space. You've got companies like CrowdStrike that are up north of 20%. So there's many examples of software-centric businesses that employ AI in their business models that have done incredibly well year to date. Many of them have very high valuations, but that's often quite typical of early leaders. That the market's very forward-looking. And they trade at very, very high multiples. And ultimately, you then expect the earnings delivery to come through and backfill those valuations. But expectations are high, obviously.
So Duolingo, isn't that surprising? It's a language app. So won't AI upend their business models?
It's an interesting one. So that's the first question that a lot of people might answer, is to say, well, with the advent of something like ChatGPT, I can dump a bunch of French text into... or English text into ChatGPT and translate it to French and learn a menu that way. But ultimately, we think the value resides in their ability to employ AI within their business model to accelerate the pace of content creation. And you'll see that they've significantly upped the speed at which they're bringing new content to market, be it a language, new language courses, or things like chess, mathematics, music even. They've expanded the range of course content that they offer. But at the same time, also creating a very curated learning experience. So the value in the AI is how you actually curate it for the customer to provide a learning experience that's guided. And obviously, there's professionals behind that do that. So it's utilizing AI to speed up your business process, but recognizing that there's still value in how you curate content for users. At the same time, they've got a new version of their app where you can now converse with a virtual character within Duolingo, where it's not just a case of being able to enter text or say a word without much feedback. You can now have a conversation with an AI, call it bot, within their app, and we think that's quite valuable, and certainly it's the fastest growing part of their app at the moment.
Can we look at the Magnificent Seven stocks? They dominated for years. So, do they still have the fundamentals to lead the market?
I don't think that they necessarily have to be market leaders. I think leadership could shift. When I talk about market leadership, I mean the stocks that create most of the outsized alpha for the indices as a whole. I think they can still do well in aggregate, but the market has become a little bit more discerning. and they're not all moving as a group like they would have done in prior years. Obviously, NVIDIA is the poster child for the AI revolution up until earlier this year. But now you've got other considerations that are coming in, and you've seen a significant derating of their multiple. It's gone from a 45 forward PE to a 25 forward PE. And to my mind, that's the market starting to think about what happens beyond the next year or two in this AI capex boom, because ultimately that's what's driving their turnover, is somebody else's capex decision. And at a certain point in time, that's going to peak and potentially taper off. We just don't know when. But as they get bigger and bigger, it becomes more front of mind for shareholders. And they're also earning peak margins right now. So are margins sustainable at a 60% operating profit margin? That's the highest it's ever been. And so these are question marks that are coming into the certainly the NVIDIA investment thesis. I think they can still do well, but it's not just a one-way bet like it might have been a year or two ago. By the same token, if you look at some of the other names, Apple's obviously been a big performer over the years, and they've benefited handsomely in recent years by a significant shift in their earnings mix away from just devices to their services ecosystem, where you've now had the benefit of a much larger installed base. Estimates are roughly that there's 1.5 billion iPhones in use today. And as that installed base continues to grow, so you're able to sell more services to that user base, which has resulted in a significant chunk of their earnings coming from services today, like 40% of their gross profit, more or less. And that's up significantly over the last 5 years, that earnings mix. And that's a very high, stable, recurring revenue stream, unlike devices, which have a cycle. But I think what the market is starting to potentially be concerned about is the fact that you just have not seen this replacement cycle coming through for their devices. In the main, the iPhone, obviously, which is their most important product. And in a way, they could be a victim of their own successes in prior years, where the iPhone has become such a good product that the improvements which with each iteration are more incremental. The battery life is much better, so you don't have the same impetus to need to upgrade. And this has resulted in effectively the replacement cycle blowing out substantially. People keep these devices for a lot longer than they used to. They don't need to upgrade every second year. You can keep them for 4 or 5 years. And so your average age of an iPhone is growing dramatically, which is great for the services business, but ultimately, in the sense that you've got more of these devices in use and the second-hand market is alive and well. But at the end of the day, from an earnings point of view, it's still the majority of their earnings is the selling of new devices, and you need to see a cycle coming through, and you haven't for quite some time. And so I think the market has started to get a little bit impatient with Apple's lack of momentum in new device sales.
Alphabet, I saw in your report, you said it's being treated as a melting ice cube by the market. Is this justified, or is there a turnaround play investors should be watching?
I think it's premature to talk about a turnaround in the sense that the profits are still growing year on year, let's be clear. So there's not a business in distress. That's the first point to make. It's a highly profitable business. But what the market has begun to sniff out, and when I say being treated as a melting ice cube, the valuation has pretty much collapsed in recent years, from well north of a forward 20 PE to, I think as recently as a few weeks ago, it was like a 16, 17 forward multiple, which is a deep discount to the S&P 500. And that is reflective of market concerns that are spelled out as being, in summary, they are a one-trick pony, because the search business is the biggest part of their profit pool by a mile. And they've enjoyed this pretty much close to a monopoly in internet search for 20 to 25 years. And for the first time in their history, they've now got real competition coming through from AI search. We've got these new large language models being developed. And I think that there's an argument to be made that it's starting to change people's habits. So you always used to Google something if you wanted information. Now there's other alternatives. And I just noted in my own personal use that I've become, for certain research functions, I use Grok, for example, we spoke about earlier, ChatGPT, and it's changed my personal habits. I reckon that my personal market share, eyeball market share of time spent on Google search has gone down. There's no doubt about that in my example. And so ultimately, I think whilst you're still seeing revenue growth, the risk that they have in their search business is that you get loss of market share over time in terms of advertising expenditure. And you've seen businesses like Meta growing their top line significantly faster than Alphabet in recent reporting periods. And so I think the market has this concern that there's a terminal value risk associated with Alphabet search business. Yes, they do have let's call it a second tier cloud business that is becoming much more profitable and growing very rapidly. They also have other bets, which include things like Waymo, but in the aggregate, those are loss making. And so right now, from a profit point of view today, search is really the dominant player, and there are question marks around their long-term moat in that business.
So with the AI revolution, semiconductor companies like NVIDIA in particular were the first beneficiaries. So who now holds the baton in the AI value chain?
Look, I think from a profit pool perspective, that's still very much the case. So in terms of dollars being spent today, NVIDIA clearly is the major beneficiary of that investment boom. But in terms of value creation or incremental value uplift, we spoke to things like Palantir earlier. We cited the example of Duolingo. These stocks that are up 50% plus year to date, that's where the market is starting to search for the next phase of uplift. Businesses that will benefit from implementing AI into their business models. The benefit of all that silicon being employed in businesses where they can leverage their software on top of that silicon to enhance business processes. So the software layer effectively is where you have seen disproportionate returns this year to date, and that could continue.
So we talk about Tesla. What is going on with Tesla?
Tesla is an interesting one. It's a bit of an enigma, despite the fact that they, for quite some time, have not been delivering growth. It still trades at a crazy high multiple. So it has this band of followers who kind of believe in the autonomy vision of creating millions of humanoid robots that people will buy, and there'll be a massive addressable market for that. But when you look at the core business today of auto manufacturing and earning a gross margin and profits on that, that's actually gone significantly backwards. Their auto margins have collapsed in the last couple of years, and the reason for that is principally, in the first instance, you've had very tight interest rate policy in most of the world, which is making any big ticket purchase item more expensive. They've tried to counter that with cutting their prices. They've adopted an approach of slashing their prices for their various models. I think their models are also getting quite old in the aggregate. Cybertruck hasn't really hit its strides. It hasn't reached the volumes that would have been projected by Elon Musk, and he's obviously quite famous for putting out projections that don't meet their potential in the near term. But basically, it's been a story of volumes under pressure, prices under pressure, and input costs have gone up. And so their gross margins have collapsed to pretty much where a traditional automaker would be, or if not worse, in recent reporting periods. So profits have been under pressure. You've also had this influence of Elon's time being pulled more and more into government circles with Doge in the US, and that's created somewhat of a backlash, I think, from certain consumers in Europe. There's a big market share loss for Tesla in a lot of countries, it would be fair to say that that's a reflection of distaste for his involvement in politics and the flavor of politics that the Trump administration represents. So that's probably had some business influence on them. Having said that, the share still commands an amazingly high premium. And I think that's a function of the market's belief, or certainly a cohort of shareholder beliefs, that ultimately, in the fullness of time, this will be an autonomy play and a clean energy play in time to come, with profits that will flow from that. So you have to view it, to buy into this valuation today, kind of north of 200 times earnings, you have to believe that this will not just be an auto company in time, but that they will make a lot of their money in future from software, from autonomous driving, from, you know, selling of robots that will do household chores, that type of stuff. It does sound pie in the sky for many, but I would also say don't fully write off Elon Musk. He's come back from worse many times before.
Can I just return to Palantir? So how much of the growth that we've seen is tied to government contracts versus organic adoption, enterprise adoption?
Yeah, so historically, Palantir was very much a defense contractor in the early days. It was founded in 2003, and a lot of their software went into government contracts to do prevention of terrorist attacks, that type of thing. So intelligence around trying to help governments foil attacks. So very much a defense contractor. In recent years, they have shifted more towards an enterprise model where they can utilize their software to basically help companies visualize their data and make more effective decisions within an enterprise more quickly, more effectively, and ultimately save costs. And it can be a wide range of applications around working capital needs or scheduling of nursing hours in a hospital. There's many different applications. Because their software is very expensive, it historically has been quite a long lead cycle of sales. Because we're talking multi-million-dollar contracts that they typically have for most customers. So it's not like a Microsoft 365 subscription. It has historically been a tough sell to enterprises. What they've recently done in the last kind of 18 months to 2 years is have these what they call AIP boot camps, where they get together at a conference and they invite companies to basically bring the information with, plug it into their system live on a screen, and they demonstrate to them what they can do for the business. And that seems to have sped up the sales cycle quite significantly, where the onboarding of customers is happening much faster. So the growth rate of the enterprise sales in the US specifically is way faster than government. I think they're growing at 70% year on year in US commercial sales versus an overall growth rate of the high 30s for the group as a whole. So that's where you're going to see this business heading in time is, whilst government remains strong, much more of an enterprise focus in time.
So volatile. How difficult is this to predict stock markets at the moment? And have you before seen this level of volatility?
We have. Every cycle is different, of course. It's been a very volatile period. I think the way to have played it, frankly, has been to have decided, at market extremes, you've got to decide. Are the share prices that are being placed in front of you, does that make long-term sense in the context of sanity ultimately prevailing? And I think that there's been a lot of fear around the imposition of tariffs and what that means. And we still don't know exactly where we're going to land. But markets also have a way of forcing policyholders' hands. That's the other point to make. And I think you've seen the market volatility has provided a valuable feedback loop to the Trump administration, where I think you've seen a subtle shift where they've dialed back perhaps the most aggressive aspects of their tariff policy, because markets have told them this is not something that is going to go too well, right? It's not going to work out well for you. And so, yes, we still have not seen where we ultimately land from a tariff point of view, but I think that the feedback loops of markets have been quite valuable for the government trying to set policy.
So Sean, can we look again at Duolingo and Palantir? Their valuations are sky high, aren't they?
Yes, that's true. I think it's fair to say that if you look at something like Palantir, it probably is the poster child for extremely high valuation in the market currently. Often market leaders have often do look very expensive and they get backfilled by fundamentals coming through, but it's worthwhile touching on the numbers. So Palantir trades at more or less a forward 200 PE. And my read of that, and it's already quite profitable, so it's not even like you're putting a high multiple on very low earnings. The margins are there, it's very profitable. But basically, you need to believe that this business can grow its free cash flows at 30 to 40% per annum for at least the next 5 to 7 years. for this share price to make sense, and then you can rationalize this. But that is a tall ask. They could do better. It's not to say they can't do better, but it's a tall ask. There's a lot of expectations built in. And if there's disappointments along the way, like one bad quarter where they miss a key metric, it's the kind of stock that will be punished. But often this is what leaders look like, and they are very volatile.
Sure. Well, it's Sean Ashton from Umber Investment. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Linda. And thanks to your listeners and readers.